Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More than 400 years ago, William Shakespeare, in his plays, came again and again to grips with justice, with truths that still illuminate our legal dramas, says my guest today. When O.J. was freed by the size of a glove, Othello was there. When Bill Clinton debated what is, The Merchant of Venice was there. When George Bush called for a war on terror, says my guest and legal scholar Kenji Yoshino, Titus Andronicus was there. This hour On Point, Shakespeare and justice. You can join the conversation. Can we listen back to learn today about the deep and subtle fundament of justice? Are you ready to hear out the bard? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Kenji Yoshino. He's a legal scholar and professor of constitutional law at New York University, author of several works on the legal system, including his last, Covering. His new book is A Thousand Times More Fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kenji Yoshino, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Let's get the sound of a little bit of this in our ears right away. When you pull it all together and show how deeply, almost into the almost minutiae of legal and jurisprudence Shakespeare got, I was kind of astonished that we have a sense of him dealing with justice. In Merchant of Venice, of course, there's the famous speech talking about the quality of mercy. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blessed him that gives and him that takes. Shakespeare weaves that right into, alongside, justice. And here's a little bit from the 2004 movie production of The Merchant of Venice. Starred Al Pacino as the merchant Shylock. Here's Lynn Collins as the she-who-would-be lawyer Portia, making her plea to Shylock, saying justice must be tempered by mercy. There's a little excerpted bit in here, but you'll see where mercy and justice intersect in Shakespeare's work.
Well, the quality of mercy is not strained. It's the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is an attribute to God himself, and earthly power doth then show like his gods when mercy seasons justice. Though justice be your plea, consider that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy.
Lynn Collins as Portia from Merchant of Venice. All right, let's just start right off here, Kenji Yoshino. I mean, here's Shakespeare, at least in the golden tongue, silver tongue of Portia, saying, hey, look beyond justice, please. You know, none of us will all finally find salvation in justice. What we need is mercy. He seems to throw even a bigger umbrella. As big as justice is, he's saying, finally, what we really need is mercy. Or is that just Portia being a good attorney?
I think it really is Portia being a good attorney. Recent productions have emphasized that Shylock has a much more sympathetic side to him. And what I try and do in my chapter, characterizing Portia as a figure for the lawyer, is to suggest that Portia actually has a dark side. So the two characters are in a pulley system. So it's natural that as Shylock's reputation rises, that Portia's reputation might fall. And what I see her doing throughout the play is manipulating language in such a way that she always gets the result that she wants. And I think that in this, she awakens her deepest fears about lawyers as sophists who win kind of victory after victory for the charmed circle in which they live at great pain and suffering to those outside of it. So even that speech, which is seen to be such a absolutely absolved speech about the necessity of mercy, can be called into question, because it seems like Shylock's depravity is suggested by the fact that he's impervious to this plea for mercy. But if you listen more closely to the cadences of the speech, she's talking about Christian mercy. So she says none of us should see salvation if we don't.
A Christian notion in itself.
Exactly. So in the course
face
of
Shylock, the Jewish merchant, of course, who's in this terrible bind.
Exactly. And she says, therefore, Jew, though justice mm-hmm. be thy plea. So she's contrasting a kind of Old Testament notion of justice that is associated with Judaism at the time with the New Testament notion of mercy.
Boy, you get the nuance of Shakespeare in the realm of justice going right here. I mean, he's got this silver tongue in the mouth of Portia. He's got these two religions, cultures, traditions meeting right there. But yet his language, he as a playwright, his language is so persuasive that all these centuries later, you know, who doesn't? I mean, we hear the quality of justice, the quality of mercy, I mean, is still something that we used to call out for that above and beyond justice. What brought you personally to Shakespeare as a kind of conduit into these subtle inner workings of justice itself?
Well, it's exactly that point that you just made, which is to say that Shakespeare's language is so beautiful that it has become universal. So I came to this book because I had this conviction that we talk way too much about law and not enough about justice.
And you're saying this as a law professor.
I know. So it's an interesting a paradox, perhaps.
Constitutional law.
I'm quite happy to talk about law in my constitutional law classes. But I think in our public culture, we need to actually broaden the frame and talk more about justice. And I think that great literature is one of the ways in which we do that. So when I was thinking about what literary texts I could use, mm-hmm. I was thinking about texts that would be common enough and complex enough. And both of those were important prerequisites. So it had to be common enough, i.e., everyone would have to know what I was talking about. We would have mm-hmm. to have a shared referent point.
Shakespeare's as good as it gets in the English great literature domain for that.
Exactly right. And I was thinking about literature that was also complex enough, right? So we have lots of literature like, say, Agatha Christie is very mm-hmm. common, mm-hmm. but it's not going to be complex enough to sustain these deep conversations about justice.
The umbrella in the dining car with the... what does Shakespeare tell us about the difference between law and justice?
Well, I think that Shakespeare often sort of runs up against the boundaries of the law and says that, you know, law by itself is not going to be adequate. So in some sense, I think King Lear is the best play for this in the sense that Lear moves from a regime in which he's talking about legal entitlements. He basically puts his three daughters on trial mm-hmm. and then makes the wrong judgment, giving the gives his estate to the two evil daughters rather than to Cordelia. And it's only actually after those two daughters turn on him and his madness sets in that he turns away from law and towards this broader sense of justice. So he makes a direct appeal to the gods, you know, to give him justice because he realizes how corrupt the legal system has become, given that it's in the hands of his enemies, Goneril and Regan. Mm-hmm. But he also begins to understand that his own legal system was corrupt, that when he was the sovereign and the head of the state, that he made misjudgments as well. So there's a great movement when he moves out onto the heath that where he moves away from law and into the world of justice and he never returns.
I was surprised when I sat down to look at this through your eyes, at Shakespeare through the eyes of a legal scholar, just how much not just broad commentary on justice is here, but quite close focus attention to the realm of jurists and judges and even law, though he asks us to look beyond law. I mean, this is this great master in Elizabethan England writing about what we think of as sort of the deepest, biggest human issues, and law is riven all through it.
Absolutely. And in fact, Mark Twain tried to make the case that William Shakespeare did not write the plays, so he was an anti-Stratfordian. Mm-hmm. And he said that the plays show so much knowledge of actual legal practice at the time that there's no way that somebody without a legal education could have written them.
Begin to take us in. You spent a lot of time with The Merchant of Venice and what we learned there on the front of law. Of course, this is where Shylock has lent money to Antonio,
exactly.
Who, as collateral, has promised if he can't return the money, he'll give, literally, he's promised a pound of flesh. And in the event he cannot deliver the money, and the pound of flesh, whether or not it should be delivered, becomes a very real issue, argued by Portia, a woman dressed as pretending to be a man. What does that light up for your law students?
Well, I think my students have the same reaction that I do, which is to say that when you actually get to the way in which she gets Antonio out of that contract for the pound of flesh, what Portia does is to say, you can take the pound of flesh, but you can't take any Christian blood. And my lawyers, my law students who have taken contracts all know that this is, as one commentator said, a miserable pedophaging trick. Because in contract law, what you learn is that if X and Y travel together and I contract with you for a pound of X, the Y goes with it unless I expressly reserve it.
But a successful trick in Shakespeare's hands. And of course, Shylock then is blocked because one drop of Christian blood and he loses everything. Everything is under law taken from him if he should shed it as a Jew, as an alien in the play.
Absolutely right. And so Shylock is both incredibly sophisticated and incredibly naive. So on the one hand, he's extremely sophisticated in that he knows that as a hated outsider, his only recourse is to use the law.
So he uses, that's all he's got.
Exactly. So he uses the power of law in order to exact his vengeance on the Christians. Where he's naive is to think that there's any legal document, including a contract, that's so airtight that a great lawyer couldn't argue his or her way out of it. And Portia, of course, does exactly that.
And that might is so great that it might spare him from the prejudices that might and the culture that surrounds the law.
Exactly. So the reason that the technicality, the miserable pedophaging trick, is good enough is because Portia's making this argument ultimately to a tribunal of Christians.
Do your law school students take from this that they shouldn't be pedophaging attorneys or that that's the way to great success in law?
I hope to think that they understand that there are limits to what can be argued, and hopefully that when they appear before a more neutral decision maker, that they will refrain from engaging in such technical, legal, or sophistical tricks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Shakespeare and justice, the bard, on what's fair, what's right, what's just in the complexity of human affairs. My guest is Kenji Yoshino, professor of constitutional law at New York University School of Law, author of the new book, A Thousand Times More Fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice. Here's a little bit of Patrick Stewart as the bloody butcher Macbeth in the 2009 BBC production. Having murdered his way to power, Macbeth now fears payback and his own downfall.
In these cases, we still have judgment here. That we but teach bloody instruction, which being taught, returns to plague the inventor. Even-handed justice commends the ingredients of our poisoned chalice to our own lips.
Macbeth and Shakespeare, Patrick Stewart and Justice, Kenji, take us into this one. What do you pull forward from Macbeth to the realm of justice in our time?
Well, I pull from Macbeth the idea that there is this notion that the universe inexorably has this karmic payback for evil doing. So we often talk about problem comedies like The Merchant of Venice that we were just discussing. In some sense, Macbeth is a solution tragedy or a reassurance tragedy in that it's clearly a tragedy, but it gives us a very reassuring vision of the universe because all the evildoers are punished in the end that seems
kind of natural justice.
There. Exactly. So that in the same way that, you know, if I drop a book, it will fall to the floor, so too, if there's any wrongdoing done in the play Macbeth, the punishment will follow inexorably onto the heels of the crime. So what we have in Macbeth is this notion that once Macbeth kills the good King Duncan, there are immediately, for example, sympathetic disturbances in nature. Nature is a word that recurs relentlessly across the course of this play. And once Duncan is killed, nature responds by having eclipses or having earthquakes, or the image that everybody remembers, Duncan's horses turn wild in nature and eat each other. Right? And so the idea is that there's nothing that Macbeth can do to escape the inevitable punishment that's going to follow him. And even before Malcolm and Macduff rise up against him, he's effectively destroyed himself.
This is justice on the grand kind of cosmic scale.
Exactly. So the idea is that there's a karmic balance to the universe in Macbeth, so that if Macbeth and Lady Macbeth do these harms, they're not only going to be punished, but they're going to be punished in a way that represents poetic justice.
You know, should we take comfort from that, or is this a matter of illusion?
I think it's a matter of illusion. So I argue very strongly against the comfort that Macbeth seems to offer, because it's a false comfort. So when we get to the modern day, we have Martin Luther King Jr. saying, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And one of my favorite commentaries on this extremely famous quote is President Obama saying, yes, the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice, but it doesn't do so on its own. We have to put our hand on that arc and make it bend towards justice. So there has to be agency. We can't sit by and just wait for the universe to work itself out. And I think so often, even extremely sophisticated people reason that, you know, if something terrible happens, then terrible consequences will occur. Or alternatively, they'll reason back from something awful that's happened to somebody to say they must have done something bad. This is a kind of blame the victim narrative.
You're saying don't count on cosmic justice. You've got to have your hand, as Barack Obama would say, on that, bending that arc that Martin Luther King described, or helping bend it. It's an active thing.
Exactly. And one of the great sort of enjoyments that I got in researching this play was actually thinking about the curse as an instantiation of the message of the play. So Macbeth is obviously famously attended by the curse that if you say Macbeth in a theater, that bad things are going to happen to you.
Right. It's bad luck to utter the word backstage. You're in the theater.
Exactly. And there are elaborate rituals that are set out in order to serve as talismans or antidotes to slipping into saying Macbeth instead of saying the Scottish play or using some other term to refer to the play. So fair thoughts and happy hours attend on you is one that's from The Merchant of Venice, seen as an unusually lucky play, or alternatively the line from Hamlet, angels and ministers of grace defend us. And so what I say is that the curse in some ways plays out in the modern day, this notion that if you do something wrong, i.e. if you say Macbeth, then bad things are going to happen to you. And so I go through all the evidence for the curse and I find it extremely thin, and I go through and systematically debunk it. So hopefully I won't be struck by lightning as I leave the studio.
Right, right.
But if I am, you'll know why.
All the world's a stage, so watch out. Obama in the context of Macbeth there, you pull George W. Bush and the issue of justice into a kind of dialogue with a couple of Shakespeare plays. One, Henry V and Titus Andronicus. Take us into those with President Bush.
Great. So the link that is most commonly made in our culture between George W. Bush and a Shakespearean character is between George W. Bush and Henry V. This is even come under the moniker of the WV connection. You know, that. So it's been so commonly made by commentators ranging from David Gergen to Marjorie Garber. So, you know, a political analyst all the way over to a literary critic. And basically, when I explore that link, what I say is I do think that there's a lot to support that link insofar as Prince Hal, as he matures into Henry V, is really drawing on three different sources of power. You know, there's feudal power, legal power, and charismatic power. Mm-hmm. So in the Henriad, there are really three different father figures that the young Prince Hal has. One is his chilly, cold, authoritarian father, who's also a king, King Henry IV. The other one is a warm, gargantuan Falstaff, who represents a very different kind of father, much warmer, but completely dissolute and unreliable. And then finally, I say that there's the father who represents the law, whom people really don't see in the conventional analyses of the play, which is the Lord Chief Justice. And ultimately, as he matures from being a wastrel into being King Henry V.
An heir and a wastrel.
Exactly. What Henry V does in redeeming time when men least think he will is to actually draw on all three sources of authority to say, I had a father who was king, so I have this patrilineal authority. I have the charismatic authority of Falstaff, so I have the common touch with the people. But then finally, I have this Lord Chief Justice, who he ultimately embraces at the very end of Henry IV, Part 2, as his legal authority, right? And so what I say is, when we think about the analogy between Henry V and George W. Bush, George W. Bush used all three of these strategies. So he drew on the legacy of his father to a certain extent.
Yes.
But when that legacy was unstable, he toggled over to seeming like the common man, the man that you would want to sit down and have a beer with.
The one who would not be like his preppy dad.
Exactly. And then when he was challenged on that grounds as being too much, you know, of the people, you know, he would toggle around to saying, but I have legal authority
I'm
for
the
whatever
decider.
I'm doing. Exactly. I'm the decider, or I can get the authorization for use of military force or what have you. So he actually converges with respect to all three, or he draws in a convergence of all three forms of authority. Incidentally, these forms of, these three forms of authority are pointed out by Weber himself as the authorities that every leader needs to draw upon. So what I say is, you know, it's now kind of out of vogue to make the comparison between George W. and Henry V. But
one's dissolute, and then moving on from there, that arc of life.
Yeah, but I think that the reason that we don't make the analogy anymore is not a good one, because I think it's only because George W. Bush didn't win his Agincourt, you know, that he didn't have the decisive military victory that Henry V did. So I think that that actually obscures, you know, the things that they nonetheless still have in common, which is actually a very masterful deployment of all three kinds of power, the feudal, the charismatic, and the legal.
There was certainly, though, a legacy from George W. Bush that in the War on Terror that you look at through the lens of Titus Andronicus and a realm in which law is very slight, if even absent.
Yes. So I get hammered a lot for using this play, because this play is uniformly reviled. It's not within the central canon of Shakespearean plays. Samuel Taylor Coleridge once called it the stupidest play ever written, not just by Shakespeare, but ever, you know, in the history of literature up to Coleridge's day. So why do I use this? Well, I use it because I actually think that Titus is a cautionary tale about how when the state is very weak, as it is in Titus, then individuals are much more likely to turn to revenge. And that's
you have rape, murder, plunder, the works.
Exactly. So what happens in Titus is that Titus Andronicus orders the death of the queen of the Goths' son, Alarbus. And after her son is killed, the queen of the Goths turns around and, with a kind of mother's world-canceling love, kind of declares a vendetta, you know, on the entire clan of Titus Andronicus. So she says, I'll raise his faction and his family. And she goes out and she makes sure that all of Titus's family is destroyed.
It's a world-canceling love or world-canceling rage.
Exactly, yeah. And Titus will come back then and bake Tamora's two sons into a pie and make her eat them in pure Senecan tragic fashion. So what you have is an escalating revenge cycle, a tit-for-tat cycle that never ends. And when you think about why this happens, it happens because there isn't any kind of rule of law that would step in to quash that.
You draw that line to 9/11 and a kind of American anger that in a way threw off world law to say no and we'll have a revenge.
Well, I want to be really careful about how I present this, because the analogy that I'm drawing is that we are actually closer today in some ways to the Elizabethans than we are to the Victorians or any other intervening period in history. Meaning that the Elizabethans were living in a time period when the rule of law was very weak at the national level. And so if somebody killed a family member, then you had to decide whether or not you were going to rely on the state, which would probably not do that much.
So you're saying it's now weak at the global level, which is in a way our new framework.
That's right. So in the same way that the law in England wasn't very powerful because there was no standing army and no effective police force, so too when we step onto an international stage where there is no such thing as a global government, we are in the position where the international law is very weak.
And power is, in a way, the law.
And we have an extreme temptation when we are harmed to engage in these revenge cycles.
So after 9/11, what do you see that draws from that?
So the caution I want to make is to say that I don't want to claim that there's an exact comparison between a vendetta that an individual engages in and a revenge cycle that is engaged in among nation states, because one is about private vengeance and the other one is about a nation declaring war. But what I do want to say is that Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once declared that the reason that we have the rule of law is to quash these revenge cycles, so that if law becomes weak, then private vendettas and vengeance are something to really look out for. So when we have no strong international law and terrorists fly planes into our building, the most natural instinct that we have is to exact some revenge on the people who did this extraordinary harm to us. And we just need to have a moment, a kind of compensatory pause, where we think about whether we're doing something purely out of blind vengeance or whether or not we are engaged in a just war. And so that's a caution that I want to draw from Titus Andronicus, which is to say that Titus Andronicus shows us in very dramatic fashion what happens when you take revenge, which is a very natural impulse, but revenge cycles spin out of control and they end up destroying not only the person who has been who's the target of the revenge, but they often destroy the avenger himself, as actually happens in that play.
Kendra, we have a lot of callers here. Let me begin to turn to them. Greenwood, Virginia, and John. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I saw Merchant of Venice recently in New York, and one thing that struck me is how I was awed by the eloquence of Portia's Quality of Mercy speech, but at the same time, utterly appalled by the results of that speech and the ways that the whole purpose and use of it to take Shylock down peg by peg until he's left with absolutely nothing.
Yes. And what do you take from that, John?
Whether the concept of justice in Shakespeare's time and our own are clearly changed, and the ways that one has to think of it in different situations, different contexts, different perspectives, different time periods.
We'll take that. I mean, also, at the same time, Kenji, you yourself say that eloquence Shakespeare hands her, you see him also judging her as misusing that justice and his full awareness of that. But, I mean, John's just seen it and struck once again at how, wow, amazing speech, turns the outcome very sharply there. But is that the way we want things to work? Are we in a different time now? Or can that eloquent jurist, lawyer today sort of, you know, bend the arc of justice to his client's interest just as effectively as Portia?
I don't think we have moved that far away in terms of the concern about lawyers. You know, when Portia enters the courtroom as a doctor of laws, I think most of us experience that less as a disguise than as a revelation of the role that she's been playing all along, which is the role of the lawyer or the sophist. The fear that there are these individuals who can make us form our judgments against rationality or what compassion would require is something that goes all the way back to Plato and his concern about sophistry and the sophist. And I think it carries all the way forward to today, where, you know, the primary fear about lawyers, as law scholar Mark Galanter has recently noted, is that they're corruptors of discourse. You know, so that one of the reasons why there are all these lawyer jokes and people hate lawyers is the idea that lawyers can talk out of both sides of their mouths and manipulate discourse in such a way that doesn't have any relationship to a notion of justice. And I don't know if this was a production that the caller saw, but the most famous recent production in New York was the Al Pacino production. And I think it was just completely masterful in its depiction of this, given that there was a pool of water in the middle. And the pool of water initially symbolizes a fountain at the center of Belmont. So it's this very idyllic world. But then later on, it becomes the baptismal font in which Shylock is forcibly converted into Christianity. And the water spills everywhere when he shakes off the water after he's been forcibly converted to Christianity. As the caller says, everything is taken away from him. And the water permeates the stage. So in Act 5, which is supposed to be the healing, happy act when we're back in Belmont and everybody is, you know, restored to a sense of harmony, at least the Christians are. While the Christians are walking around, the water seeps into their garments. And it's almost a sense of, in watery Venice, the idea is that that guilt has permeated the play in such a way that it's soaking into their garments and is inescapable.
Shakespeare speaking in a very current terms to us across 400 years. Kenji Yoshino's new book is 1,000 times more fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice. Behind us here, the chorus of the Scottish Exiles from Macbeth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Shakespeare and justice, the bard, on what's fair, what's right, what's just in the complexity of human affairs. Legal scholar Kenji Yoshino is with me. His new book is A Thousand Times More Fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice. It's funny, a little bit in the news here, a very slight example, but nevertheless, just this week, a federal judge in Wichita, Kansas, granted a request to delay a civil case involving a dispute over a stock transaction because one of the lawyers was expecting his first child 2 weeks after the trial was scheduled to start. The judge quoted Shakespeare in the proper comportment of legal adversaries. He says, quoting him, saying, legal adversaries who, quoting Shakespeare, drive mightily, but eat and drink as friends, a little time off to have the baby. Merchant of Venice, at the heart of Kenji Yoshino's reference to Shakespeare. There's a lot more than that, but there is certainly that. Here's a little bit from Portia again, from Merchant of Venice, played here by Joan Plowright, playing on the word fair, as in justice and as in beauty, when she's united with her lover, Bassanio.
You see me, Lord Bassanio, where I stand, such as I am. Though for myself alone, I would not be ambitious in my wish to wish myself much better. Yet for you, I would be trebled 20 times myself. 1,000 times more fair. 10,000 times more rich.
Yet for you, I would be 1,000 times more fair, 10,000 times more rich. And from this, you draw your title. I have to say, as I listen to that, I'm thinking mainly beauty there. Is she really saying I'd be 1,000 times more just to her lover? Does he care?
No, I'm appropriating it in the sense that I actually think that when we enter into a community, particularly a community of love, we see that we both want to be more beautiful and that we want to be more fair. So as the scholar Elaine Scarry has pointed out, fair in the sense of justice actually comes from the word fair in the sense of beauty.
Does Shakespeare link them?
He doesn't in that particular passage, mm-hmm. but I think that more broadly, he often puns off of the two senses of the word fair. And what I want to sort of stress there is to say that we shouldn't assume that there's any intrinsic relationship between justice and beauty. You know, Aristotle and others thought that there was like an intrinsic relationship between the two, describing justice, for example, as the perfect cube, you know, the thing that comes pleasantly to the eye. I'm not trying to argue in this book that fairness is beauty inexorably is linked to fairness is justice. But what I am saying is that fairness is beauty is something that we can use in order to have the conversations that we need to have in order to become a more just society. So that's the way in which the two words are linked for me.
I want to run through some more of these terrific examples. You're looking at the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings and the debate around them, drawing lines back to the Bard, back to Shakespeare. What network do you see? What web between the two?
Yeah. This confirmation hearing, as well as actually the Kagan confirmation hearing, sort of drove me crazy because what we had is a conflict between two different models. One is the umpire calling balls and strikes, you know, the
Chief Justice view of the world.
Exactly. And then the other one is the empathy standard, where mm-hmm. Obama says that, you know, he wanted his justices to be empathetic.
And he was chewed on for saying that by those who don't buy that view of the world.
Exactly. And what, you know, this will seem odd, given that I've just praised President Obama, but what I see is that both of these sides, both of these extremes are really, really troubling and pernicious, and that we should just eliminate both of these extreme models at the outset.
The extreme, I guess, but yet you need to understand the letter of the law, and I guess you're suggesting you need some empathy at the same time. Are we really talking extremes here? Do you think Sotomayor and Kagan were like off the charts empathetic at the expense of the opposite? Sotomayor certainly doesn't sound that way on the bench.
Oh, not at all. I think that Sotomayor and Kagan were exactly in the middle. What I'm criticizing is not the justices themselves, but rather the two models that were being offered in the confirmation hearings. One was the kind of letter of the law, umpires calling balls and mm-hmm. strikes, and then the other one was a supposedly completely standardless empathy. Mm-hmm. But if you looked at what, you know, Justice Sotomayor, even as a judge, you mm-hmm. know, in her time in the Second Circuit, had been doing, you know, she, like every other judge, used some combination of looking at the letter of the law and then adjusting the law, as we all have to from time to time, in order to express empathy or compassion or equity.
How does Shakespeare address this?
Before her. Well, Shakespeare, I think, addresses this squarely in the play Measure for Measure, which is, for me, a play about judgment. So we have the two extreme models. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we start the play out, actually, on the empathy side, with a duke who is so empathetic, who is so compassionate, that he pardons everybody. He doesn't enforce the laws. And Vienna actually is sinking into anarchy because of this. Liberty plucks justice by the nose, and the baby beats the nurse in this
world. The baby beats the nurse. Let's get it together here.
Exactly. And so what he does is he leaves the state in the hands of his deputy, Angelo. So this is straight mm-hmm. out of the Machiavellian playbook, which is to say you create a mess and then...
You take care of it,
Angelo. Make somebody else be the bad guy. Yeah. And so Angelo comes in and he sort of marks a kind of stern return of the law. And when people ask him for mercy, he gives a really cogent response, which is to say that he says, I show it most when I show justice, for then I pity those I do not know, right?
Take us through that. I show it most when I show justice, for then I pity those I do. In other words, it's not a matter of sympathy. It's a matter of the law.
Actually, what he's saying is that you can have mercy for individuals
yes.
as an individual,
mm-hmm.
but once you become a state actor, once you become the government, if a court mm-hmm. is sympathetic or mm-hmm. too compassionate mm-hmm. to the parties mm-hmm. before them, mm-hmm. then they're actually being not compassionate to all the other
the
people
whole.
Who have to live under the rule that's created for that particular
because
case.
Because if not, you'll lose sight of the law and its framework, and pretty soon the baby beats the nurse and everything's in an uproar.
Yes, and Justice Breyer sort of embraced this quotation at a Shakespeare in the Law conference recently when he said that, I think about this quote, you know, or he says that, I don't know how many times that I've said or thought, I'm not just deciding this case for the parties who are before us. I have to think about the 298 million Americans who are not before me today mm-hmm. and handing down this rule of law, right? And then he said, and then I looked at Measure for Measure, and there it was. And that was exactly the quote that he plucked out,
oh,
which
perfect.
Is to say that he shows pity, although the true quote is, I show it most when I show justice, for then I pity those I do not know.
We've
so,
got it.
What I'm trying to say here in the Measure for Measure chapter is that there's a kind of triple pun in the title, which mm-hmm. is to say Measure for Measure can mean judge not lest ye be not judged, mm-hmm. the Sermon of the Mount sense
yes.
of Measure for Measure. It can also mean, you know, mete out the measure as it is meted out to you in the sense of the Talionic law of an eye for an eye, a tooth mm-hmm. for a tooth,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And those seem to be the two extremes. But the third way is the middle way of judging with measure, which is represented by the character Aeschylus mm-hmm. in the play. In the same way that the Duke represents the too soft notion of empathy and Angelo, his deputy, represents the too hard notion of the letter of the law. Aeschylus actually understands, like, you know, as I think Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan do, that justice requires the middle way, the via media. And his name actually means scales in Latin. And so we're hearkening back to a Greco-Roman notion of Measure for Measure there.
Aeschylus on the via media. Kenji Yoshino's new book is 1,000 times more fair, what Shakespeare's plays teach us about justice. Mimi's calling from Boston. Hi, Mimi. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I've been listening to this. I mean, I'm a lawyer, and I have been an assistant district attorney in the past, and I practiced in Suffolk County. And, I think it's a fascinating conversation. I mean, the thing about the law is that the law is meted out by people and humans. And so, as we know, humans are... reflect their culture and their history
yes.
and the history of what's going on in the country. And so it's not an easy answer. I mean, I think that you have to have equity and you have to have justice, but justice is through the eyes of the beholder, right? So Elena Kagan is a good example of somebody who I think struggles with being equitable, but we can't pretend that it's not a measure of, I mean, it's like that whole question of, what is judicial activism? I mean, judicial activism is through the eyes of the other side. I mean, the courts, by their very nature, are about judicial activism. I mean, you make policy through the courts. You have to. You do.
Mm-hmm. It's an act of justice, not a passiveness of justice that we describe. Mimi, our time grows short. I'm so glad for your call, but let us pick it up with justice in the eye of the beholder. What about that view of justice in Shakespeare?
Yeah, I think I want to go back to the point about how judicial activism is in the eyes of the beholder and how, you know, as one commentator says, judicial activism just means a judge has made a decision that you disagree with.
Right.
And what I want to point out there is that in both Measure for Measure and in modern day life, it's very hard not to engage in some form of judicial activism. So Angelo, who stands for the non-activist form of judgment, i.e. the letter of the law in the play, is ultimately not able to cleave to his own standard. And similarly, when we look at the umpire calling balls and strikes, you know, that quotation mm-hmm. comes from Chief Justice John Roberts,
yes.
you know, a jurist whom I immensely admire. Nonetheless, when we look at a case like Citizens United, where he's actually interpreting the free speech clause to protect corporations, that requires active interpretation. That's not just an umpire calling a ball or a strike. That's a very aggressive interpretation of the free speech clause.
Speaking of Eye of the Beholder, the issue of ocular justice comes up in Othello. You relate it back to no less than O.J. Simpson, his trial, and Johnny Cochran. Tell us.
So I love Othello as a commentary on human epistemology and how we know what we know and what counts as proof for us. So mm-hmm. what I do is I compare the bloody glove in the O.J. Simpson trial to the white handkerchief in Othello, which is spotted with strawberries.
The evidence of the betrayal and, of course, in Johnny Cochran's hands, if that glove won't fit, you must acquit.
Yes, and what's happening in both instances is that the metaphysical question of guilt or innocence is rather complicated. And when the metaphysical questions get hard, we have a tendency to funnel down into thinking about the physical evidence as being dispositive.
It's like it's all too much. Let me just stare at the glove or stare at the speckled handkerchief?
Exactly. And so when we look at the handkerchief, ultimately the handkerchief in Othello becomes the proof of Desdemona's guilt or innocence. So if Desdemona has lost the handkerchief, then she's guilty. If she's retained the handkerchief, then she's innocent. Similarly, in the O.J. Simpson trial, if the glove fits, then you have to acquit. You know, if the glove doesn't fit, you have to acquit. Mm-hmm. And if the glove fits, then you can actually convict, right? And as one of the jurors said afterwards, you know, when asked why she acquitted, she said, well, the glove didn't fit. You know, I didn't think that the glove fit.
But you're describing that in a way as a kind of surrender, a kind of a human throwing up our hands and saying, the metaphysics of this are too much. Just show me something I can hinge an opinion on.
Yes, I look at it as an extremely dangerous tendency, as evidenced in the outcome of both Othello and the O.J. Simpson trial. I experience this as a form of cognitive bias on the part of human beings to focus on the form of ocular proof rather than to wrestle with the deeper conceptual subtleties of justice. So we have a tendency as human beings that when we can't measure what's important, we make important what we can measure, right? And so when the metaphysical questions become hard, we look for the ocular proof and we seize on that ocular proof and make it too important, as evidenced in both of those examples.
Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York, and Charlie. Charlie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I want to thank you very much. This is probably, of all of the topics we have covered this week, this is one of the most profound you've had in quite some time.
Mm.
The use of Shakespeare as almost a lamp unto my feet in terms of the kind of mental process that people have to go through in order to make decisions or to justify decisions.
Yes, sir.
Comes out so clearly in this gentleman's work. I can't say enough about it in terms of, and the lack, as we talk about education today, the moving away from the classics and the Shakespearean type of analytical process. It does a disservice to America in terms of the intelligence that people have to bear in order to analyze what occurs in the natural process here.
Charlie, that's good. We need to muster all of our resources, not let the grand old Shakespeare go. And I really appreciate your call there from Buffalo. Kenji, our time begins to grow short, but there's another president that you drag in here, Bill Clinton. And it's in that whole blue dress Monica Lewinsky quadrant. And when Bill Clinton, a highly trained lawyer himself, a Yale law grad, gets down into what is, your ear turns back to Shakespeare once again.
Yes, and actually this is the through line that I draw from The Merchant of Venice. So when Bill Clinton famously said, it depends on what the meaning of the word is.
Yeah.
I think that's a moment at which he lost the sympathy of
people just
the
shaking
American
their heads.
People.
Come on.
And I think that the reason that we lost sympathy for him is that he revealed himself in that moment as the lawyer that he was, you know, so that until that point, it just looked like he was being hounded and persecuted to at least many individuals who are sympathetic to Clinton.
But this isn't the same as Portia's eloquence. This is a kind of parsing. This is a kind of highly legalistic parsing.
Well, I want to say that it's actually exactly what Portia does,
really?
Not in the Quality of Mercy speech, but later on, because it's exactly this kind of hair splitting that goes on when she says, you can have a pound of flesh, but you can't have any blood. I mean, come on, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way, I think that we react to that and we say, that's ridiculous, you know, because those two things go together. And in fact, what she says that also is that Shylock can only take a pound of flesh, and that if he takes even a little bit more, even in the estimation of a hair, she says, to go to play in our hair-splitting theme, right, that he's going to be criminally liable for trying to take the life of a citizen.
We've just got a minute. What should we take? Broad, broad stroke here from Shakespeare. If we listen to William Shakespeare, how would we change the way we hold justice, law in our hands today?
I think what we would take away from Shakespeare is the idea that great art has something to contribute to our deepest conversations about justice, and that we do ourselves an enormous disservice when we focus too much on law as the be-all and the end-all. One of the great constitutional law scholars, Robert Cover, once said that every constitution is embedded in an epic, and for every decalogue, there's a scripture. What he meant by that is that there is no law that isn't embedded in a set of narratives that give it shape or meaning, and that I think our law and our notions of justice are deeply embedded in the narratives and the stories that we tell each other, including, but of course not limited to, the bard himself.
The Shakespearean narrative, no mean frame around our lives, and the laws we work within. Kenji Yoshino has been my guest, and what a pleasure to have you. The new book is 1,000 times more fair, What Shakespeare's Plays Teach Us About Justice. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kenji Yoshino, a professor of constitutional law at New York University School of Law, with me in the studio today. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom. What folly I commit, I dedicate to you.
And we'll take it. We go out with Flocabulary and To Be or Not. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
To be or not to be. Somehow it just came to me. In a question, what's life? What's death? If there's no one left, so I ask you to be or not to be.